Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowery. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these folks. Conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today, we're talking to Matthew Fisher. Welcome, Matthew, to Zero Hour, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tim, very much.
That's where you. Thank you, Tim. Yep. It's good. We're off to a good start here. Matthew and I just met, so we're jumping into this like you would jump into.
We're on a date.
Like a blind date. That's what we're having, a blind date here. Yes. A blind interview. Would you mind closing your eyes? Okay. So since I don't know a thing about you, this is going to be a very revealing experience for me as well as to the listeners. Why don't you give me a little bit of information about your education and your background?
Absolutely, Tim.
Okay, that's friendly. Okay, good. Moving right.
And yes.
Yes. And cut.
Thank you, Tim. I did graduate school here at VCU back in 98 through 2000. Before that, I was in Ohio at the Columbus College of Art and Design. Mm-hmm. And since 2000, I lived up in New York City. And the way I see it, looking back, what Columbus College of Art and Design gave me was a great training and academic skills, mm-hmm. with not an emphasis on conceptual skills. And when I was able to do my grad work here at VCU,
right.
It was almost the opposite.
So you sort of learned how to play the instrument, and then you came here and...
Learned how to sing.
Yeah,
learned and how then to, once know. I graduated, I put those two together over the course of time.
Really. So you really feel like you learned a lot of technical skills as an artist in your undergraduate work?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
It was a program that was derived from...
You can call me Tim.
Okay. Tim. Okay.
I know I command this air of respect, but...
It was a program born out of Joseph Albert's school of thought. Mm-hmm. So we learned a lot of the Munsell color chart, 2D design, 3D design, color concept, a lot of figure drawing. And what I was able to do at the end of that 4 years was say nothing really well.
Yeah, yeah. Right, exactly. So you had a lot. You developed a lot of skills. And then you came here to VCU that really is at the opposite end of the spectrum as far as that goes.
Exactly. And here I would try to figure out what I was trying to say, and people were more tuned to that. And it was for me...
Especially, that's a very interesting concept, because I think a lot of people, not maybe listening to this show, but a lot of people would think, well, you went there and you learned those skills, and I guess you learned how to draw and how to utilize color, and the kinds of things that people think you need in order to make a nice picture, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like the way, I guess, that some people are sentimentally attached to sort of Thomas Kincaid kind of things, which are sort of, to most people who have studied anything beyond just the basics of art, you know, those are just sentimental sort of slop. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're well-done sentimental slop, but they're sort of sentimental slop. And so if art isn't about sentimental slop, then what is it about? I mean, where did you go from you arrived here sort of with that kind of background. Where did VCU take you as far as your thinking in art? Because I think that's a real chasm there. People think that art is a nice picture. Or like I was going to say, I was going to call this show, I Could Have Done That, right?
I wish I could have done
that. And the answer is, yeah, well, you didn't, you know.
Exactly.
But, you know, the look at, you know, expressionist art and say, oh, well, it's just splattered on the paper or whatever. So what's the difference between a pretty picture or eye candy, as Duchamp used to call it, and making art?
Wow.
We only have a half an hour, so.
For me, in the end, it's the intent of the artist, the presence of their hand.
The presence of their hand.
Yeah, how they made it, what they made it, their decision. Personally, I have nothing against sculpture, photography, installation, but mm-hmm. what I love about painting and drawing is that the directness between viewer and artist is that of the paintbrush, pencil, hand. And I can see the thought process, how these artists were thinking, And in some ways, you
well,
almost
talk about that a little bit.
You become a part of the artist's vision because you can see how they kind of, you know, you make this mark and it's an extension of yourself as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, like, I recently curated a show called The Object Direct, and I was kind of basing the show off a retort to California, L.A. Finnish mm-hmm. fetish. And with those artists, which were fantastic, Ken Pierce, Ed Ruscha, the process disguised the artist's hand. It wasn't really about exposing the touch of the artist. It was about allowing how they painted or how they sculpted to conceal what their actions. And I think within my generation, or within the last, since 2000, since the death of postmodernism, there's been an openness of acceptance of allowing yourself to be present in the final
mm-hmm.
piece.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not just about the process, it's about the artist, it's about the thinking, the decision making, and letting that being all out there.
Interesting. Because when you said the death of postmodernism, you know, since the death of postmodernism in, what did you say, 2000?
This is my own opinion.
I
graduated VCU in 2000. Mm-hmm. What I learned, I was greatly influenced by the wonderful teachings of Shirley Kinnaird and David Reed.
Mm-hmm.
It was a strong postmodern tradition then. We're coming off all these great artists from the 90s that were using the idea of doubling back, of the recreation of the creation. And something happened. Postmodernism in itself is an end. And something happened around the summer of 2000.
How do you see it as an end?
Because how many recreations of a creation can one do?
Right.
You know, eventually you're going to recreate yourself into a corner where there's mm-hmm. nowhere to go. And mm-hmm. and that's fine if you got to the party early. But since I got my degree in 2000,
right.
I showed up at, you know, the last person to show up at the party. And everybody was walking out the
you
door.
Said, I have an idea.
Yeah.
We'll do a recreation.
Hey. Here's something new, guys. And I was in a room by myself.
So what came next? I mean, you've kind of said it, but I'm just going sort of back through it again.
For myself, what came next was investigation into the possibilities of painting.
Mm-hmm.
And that resulted in 2 years of mediocre work where I thought painting could be anything or everything. Because there really was no guidance right then. You know, there's...
I mean, that's a fairly postmodern thought, though.
It is, but at the same time, and it was also... I learned quickly that was... I invited myself to the same party that was already over.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't going to work. That, yes, painting can be everything, but what is painting to you as an artist? And at that point...
Interesting point.
I looked at everything I was doing. Mm-hmm. I was doing the whole range of abstraction to representational. If you can think of, you know, Glenn Brown's paintings from the YBAs...
I don't, but...
He kind of reinvestigated this idea that painting is both... a reproduction and object and abstraction and representational and photographic and mm-hmm. photographic representational. And I looked at what I was doing and I just realized that, yes, that is a possibility, but it's so open, it's so
right.
unknown in its openness that you got to figure out within this realm of everything, what do you want? And I focused on this one aspect that I enjoyed at the moment,
mm-hmm.
which I you know, tongue-in-cheekly labeled thrift store realism.
Right.
Where I was interested in painting, like, have you ever been to a thrift store and you see this really amazing photorealistic painting where it's so uh-huh. real it becomes right. unreal?
Uh-huh.
Thrift store realism. That being...
Thrift store realism.
Okay. Every hair is painted, every blade of grass is painted, but the structure which everything hangs on isn't necessarily
right.
realistic.
Mm-hmm.
So I was interested in the details. Highly detailed, but not necessarily realistic.
Right. Okay, so thrift store realism. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Have you ever been to the thrift store and you come across the bin of paintings, and within that bin of paintings, there's... I can think of one off the top of my head that I saw many years ago. It was a painting of a guy riding a horse in a horse race. And within that painting, it was done so real, so photorealistic, it
right.
became unreal. And I'm not really interested in the idea of photoreal, but I'm interested in the idea of being... so unreal that through that unrealness, it becomes unreal.
And it's unreal or real?
I don't know. We should re-edit that. Through the idea being that the work is detailed, but not realistic. Like within the painting, every blade of grass is painted, every highlight in the hair is painted. There's leg hairs. Like I just finished a painting mm-hmm. recently where I ended up painting some dude's leg hairs. And you know, I'm painting the weave of a tartan's kilt, and these are things that you might not notice, but to me they're important. The idea that they're there and that when you look at them, you see them. And I kind of trace this back to this when I was an undergrad. Like I just could never do that, like that great Robert Motherwell gestural mm-hmm. icon mm-hmm. where he's just like,
yeah, just big
and leave it. Like that's the beauty right. of Motherwell. Like he could just and leave it. And for me, I would always kind of do that and look at it and I'd try to go in and manipulate a little part.
See if you could put a kilt on it.
Yeah, not necessarily that, but like, you know, you just want to like, oh, this needs a little yellow over here. But with the way my work has developed or matured, I can't noodle enough. Like I'll paint a kilt, and then I'm like, oh, I gotta paint the plaid, and then it's like, nah, you gotta go and you gotta paint the weave of the plaid, and it's like the more noodling I do, the more it becomes real in a way.
To what end for you? I mean, what is this about for you?
In a way, and this sounds, you know, the F word that they don't let you use in school. It's about formulas. Like I love. The more I do, the more richer these patterns become, these textures become, the more richer the painting becomes. It's just the more richer it overall becomes.
It really sounds like a marriage of your early education and now more conceptual.
Definitely.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, I do owe you that $70.
So after a thrift store, what did you call it? Thrift store realism?
Yeah.
Yeah. After that. Are you still doing thrift store realism?
I am. I'm from the caveman. I got tired of doing Naked Harry. And
who's Naked Harry?
The thrift stores, the caveman. The caveman. Yeah. You know how many times can you paint? You know, you paint this beautifully masculine man. You got paint on his hair. But this is right around the time U.S. invaded Afghanistan.
How do you paint hair?
With a very fine brush.
No, I'm serious. I really. Can you do hair with just a line? Is it just a line, or is it something else going on?
It depends.
That
on
might
the
sound
hair.
Like a stupid question.
No. On the hair, like on the hair on the head, you. I'm gonna have to charge you now. I'm charging you now $70. You'd paint the form of the hair. On top of that, you'd paint the individual hairs, and then the highlights. And if you're interested in making it kind of like a reddish, you might glaze it red, and then highlights on top of that. But if it's hair on the body. You can get by with just a line, yeah. And in particular, like with the stubble, if you ever paint stubble, mm-hmm. like a five, you know, like a 3-day-year-old beard,
right.
You can get by with just a line. And you got to draw the line, you know. You could try to paint the highlights on that, and it just becomes
really
you go
3-day stubble with highlights.
That's the end of the line. You've gone too far.
Okay, so Naked Harry. Is moved on.
I moved on to. I purchased these books.
Actually,
about...
you should do just Naked People, because then you wouldn't have to do the hair. See,
shave,
much faster.
Shave Naked People.
Good point.
Well,
okay, we're going to take a quick break. We're talking with Matthew Fisher, who is down from New York City. He graduated from VCU, and he's down here to talk to some students about his experiences up there and his life as a painter. Now back to the interview.
From there, I went on to French soldiers from the Napoleonic era. Because I wanted to discuss our current political situation, that being the invasion of Iraq,
right.
Before that, the invasion of Afghanistan, without being in your face, very, very forceful. And I saw these soldiers as kind of being a backdoor into this like current political times.
I'm sorry, soldiers? Which soldiers?
I'm sorry, the French soldiers. No, the French Napoleonic soldiers. Because their outfits, first of all, you know, I went to school in Richmond. I was from the north. I did not want to deal with the landmine field of racial mm-hmm. of slavery, of all that. And I didn't know anything about Napoleon. And then in hindsight and learning a little bit more, it was just as bad.
Right.
But not knowing that, I was able to approach these uniforms that were ridiculously ornate. These soldiers were wearing plumes. They had cover buns, spats. You know, they were so good looking mm-hmm. to go in and mm-hmm. fight and shoot and stab one another. And it was just outrageous. And it also reminded me of when I was back in high school, I was in the marching band and we wore these same outfits, you know, right. in Sergeant Pepper style. Right. It was just, but I just had a laugh. I was like, look at these hats, some of these hats. And the funny thing is within my work, I've used a lot of them, but there's certain ones where I just can't use because unless you know the history of these uniforms, you would think I'm nuts. They're just so ornate. These many feathers, three, 4 feet high off their heads. But I was just drawn to these as this icon of military warfare and what that stood for and how that mimicked our current.
What did it stand for, and how does it mimic our current?
It was a stand-in for national identity, mm-hmm. of threat, of protection, of enemy, of hero, of conqueror.
Pretty much all the themes that are running.
Exactly, what's good in an army if they just sit around and guard an undefended territory? So right. there was all these undercurrents racing through these really great images, and the colors and the patterns that they possessed was so fantastic that I was able to use them and talk about this tragedy that America had, this turn mm-hmm. life altering mm-hmm. projection that we've been on since then, without being so in your face that all you could see was Bin Laden.
Right, without doing paintings of guys fighting in Iraq.
Exactly.
Or
but that was what it was about. These are the themes that have, you know, and sadly, these are the themes that have been a part of modern history for forever, for the last 2,000 years of hatred, of conquering, of dividing, of trying to control and reassimilate people that did not.
So are you interested in the violence inherent in these images? Is there violence inherent in, or is these just...
Early on, there was violence, but as the works kind of came about, they sadly became a stand-in for my personal life of being sad and single and alone because I went through a kind of a painful divorce at this time. And then I became interested in this idea of what happens in between war. Because even though you're at war, even though you're fighting these battles, you're not doing that 24/7. So what do you do in between these wars? Do you reflect? Do you think about home? Are you just glad to be alive?
So you went through a war.
Personal divorce. War, yeah. And I've gone through it again.
Yeah.
In recent time. But you know, the short answer I tell people, the best way to understand my work is just think of a lonely guy with his cat. And you'll see a loneliness within the figures. There's usually some sort of animal, not necessarily a cat, but like a monkey, a cow, or something that's a stand-in for my big cat. And
a lonely cow, yes.
Yeah, yes. A lonely soldier. And that's what they're about. But I was more interested not in the fighting and the killing in that, because all that was implied within the uniform. Mm-hmm. I was interested in these quiet moments. What do you do with yourself when you're not fighting on Tuesday, but you're going to fight on Wednesday, and you fought on Monday? How do you entertain yourself? What's your thoughts? What are you thinking about? Are you just happy to be alive? And that's kind of what the work's about. It's not really about the violence, because the uniform implies that violence. It's about these quiet moments in between the battles, where it's just you, your clothes, and the world itself.
Well, life.
Life, yeah.
Yeah.
It's life.
I mean, yeah. It's what most of life is. I mean, even guys who go to war, unless they were in Vietnam or something, or probably Iraq too. But, you know, they talk about these long periods. It's just, you know, the worst but the hardest part about it was just the boredom of sitting and waiting.
When's the next bullet going to come?
Yeah, right. But, I mean, that's you know, and you hear movie stars who say, Ella Fitzgerald used to say, I live the most boring life in the world. People say, what do you mean? She say, I sit in the green room and I watch soap operas. And then I go out on stage, and I belt them out, and I come back in, and I watch the rest of the soap opera.
That's funny, because in some ways, that could be a stand-in for an artist, you know? Everybody's romantic about the notion of the artist, and what do you... You know, for me, where they're like, oh, what'd you do today? I'm like, I painted grass for 10 hours.
Right.
You know, I want to kill myself. I showed up at 10 a.m., and all I could think about was me being at the bar at 8:30 p.m., you know? And it's...
Right.
But it's what's got to be done.
So for you as an artist, right, the whole idea... The whole idea of you're talking about work, you're talking about putting in hard work, and I mean that's something that I think. Well, it's not true. I think a lot of people still hold on to the romantic idea of an artist, and you know it's fun, and you go in the studio and you have a fun time. You know what you do is you go in and you slog through life and wait for inspiration, which you know comes few and far between usually for most artists, but most of it is just kind of grinding it out and being disciplined. And do you agree with that or not?
I do, and I think, you know, I don't want to put a tear in anybody's beer because I'm very, very, very lucky to be where I am today and have the opportunity to be where I am today, but it is work, you know. I'm fortunate. Most of the time I only work 2 days a week for another company driving a truck. the other 5 days a week, it's up to me.
How do you do that? I mean, how do you feel good about yourself in this kind of culture, driving a truck 2 days a week and then going working in a studio? Have you had a certain amount of success? I've
been in group shows, solo shows, and I've been able to make, I don't make my majority of my money off of my work, but I make a good, less than half. It's able to fill in the gaps.
What keeps you going then?
For monetary wise?
No. Oh. Just making art. What is...
Because, I was talking earlier today to some students. It's, when I'm working on these paintings, if I laugh at them, I know at least one person in this world finds them funny. and sometimes I'll it's hard because especially recently in the last year, I've scaled up to like 5 foot by 7 foot right. size. Mm-hmm. And these take a lot of time and you got to hold yourself interested in them. Mm-hmm. And, part of it is the expectations of who you are, who you've become. People expect a certain type of painting out of it. Mm-hmm. And with that in mind, you gotta make them fun to yourself. So there's moments where I just kind of laugh and I'm like, and there's other parts of me or a larger part of me that says, this is what's got to be done. And there's a blind faith. There's definitely a blind faith that what I do in that studio, somebody's going to care about. Mm-hmm. And I'm lucky that there's a few people that do, and hopefully I'm lucky that there's a few people that they know that care about it too.
Yeah, but that doesn't seem to be the driving force for you at all.
It's you got to do it.
Yeah,
that's the driving force. There's no other excuse. It's what I've risked everything. I've lost everything, and it's just
that's interesting you say that because I've had a lot of artists say that, and one of the things I say is that I think it takes a tremendous amount of personal courage in this culture to become an artist.
Yeah,
and I'm not saying that just to.
It's one and the same,
I mean, you're obviously bright and capable and could be doing other things, right? You could be.
Driving a truck
full time.
I could be doing a radio interview full time.
You could be doing radio full time. Probably better than me.
Yeah.
But hey, now wait a minute here. This is my show. You know what I'm saying?
No, it's a try and answer.
But something about, you said risk. You've risked everything. You've lost everything. Talk about that.
You're all in. I know these are like cliche answers.
No, I don't think so.
And people want to know, how do you pay your rent? And the truth is, there's a lot of blind faith. You just know. I've been in New York City for 8 years, and I know that I was trying to make a dentist appointment last week, and they were asking me questions like, when can I do it? And I was like, I honestly don't even know what month it is.
Right.
And the only days that are important to me are the firsts, when rent is due. And everything else is just somewhere in between firsts. And you just got to, I know where I need to be. And I don't want to say I'm fortunate, but, I'm single right now, so I don't have to answer anybody else. I put it all out there. And if my bank account gets really low, that just means I can't do anything that week. And and it's been like that for like a couple of years now. And it's kind of like you don't want to be the artist that flogs himself like, woe is me, I got no money. But that's what you got to do to make it. Because in particular in New York City, what's most important and what's most valuable is time. Time in the studio. And only you can give yourself time. And there's sacrifices that come with that.
Mm-hmm. So how long are you going to keep at it? I mean, do you have an end game? Do you have
you want a one word answer?
Yeah.
Death.
Really?
Yeah, it's hokey, but my 401k is in the toilet right now, and what I make right now is my 401k. We had a running joke. We're mortgaging our future with hopes of a better return.
Yeah,
and that's where I'm at. I think I keep coming back to the term blind faith. I'm just optimistic that what I'm doing is important, and I've been fortunate that people find it important, and I've had opportunities to exhibit my work, and other people.
So your self-worth comes from that process. I guess that's what I'm getting at.
Now we're back to that.
That's it. Yeah. No, I mean, we're back to $70 an hour now. Right now it's $100 an hour.
My self-worth.
But because you live in a culture where people's self-worth is measured by how much money they make, what position they hold, all those things. And you drive a truck 2 days a week, and the rest of the time you're sort of invisible.
Well, I call driving a truck my hobby.
Right.
And the other 5 days a week is what I do for a living.
Yippee, I get to drive today.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, sometimes
well, like,
it's nice.
Mark Twain said, you know, anything you do all the time becomes work, so, you know.
Yeah, well, that is true.
So your hobby may well be driving a truck.
It is. I like the call. I like it.
Yeah.
What I imagine, you know, it's, to be completely honest with you, it is the weirdest experience I've ever had in my adult life.
Uh-huh.
This idea that 5 days a week I wake up, and it really doesn't matter what I do. I could stay in bed.
Right.
I could surf the internet. Mm-hmm. Or I could go to the studio. And honestly, the world's going to move on the same pace. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to really notice. And you become your own boss. It's up to you to go into the studio and paint. You know, today I'm going to paint 10 hours worth of grass. You know, and
really?
It's just, and I guess it's a job, like you said earlier. It becomes mm-hmm. a job. Like Mark mm-hmm. Twain said, it's a job. And but the greatest feeling in the world.
Love.
It's a job I love. Well, I don't love the job, but what I do love
yeah.
is when I finish a painting. Mm-hmm. And I've spent 3 months on this painting, and it's done, it's signed, it's titled, the tape's off, and you look at it on the wall, and, I mean, this sounds really lame, but the feeling is almost greater than sex. Like, you're looking at this thing, and you're just like, you're pumping your fist, you're so excited, and then I have a ritual where I always go out and get a Brooklyn Pilsner. And enjoy that. And you're high on life for one night.
Right.
And you go to bed and you wake up and you come back to the studio next morning and you have a blank canvas. And you got to start it all over. So honestly, in a given year, I have 12 extremely happy nights. And everything else is just
awful.
That's
wonderful. That's 12 more nights than most people have in their entire life. And I mean that. I really mean that.
Oh, thank
I'm
you.
Serious. Yeah.
Thank
you know,
you.
When you think about that, think about all the people out there who, you know, endless jobs. They don't know what they're doing. They don't know why they're doing it. They're just sort of moving through life. They're married to somebody maybe they don't even really care about. They've got this job. It's like, yeah. You know, and then all of a sudden one day they're dead. So you got, yeah, you got,
well, I got the end.
You got 12 nights that a lot of people never get, even in a lifetime, which is wonderful. Well, thank you, Matthew Fisher, for talking with us today. And thank you folks for listening. Hope to see you on the radio again next Friday at 12:30. This is Tim Bowring, and you're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond's Indie Radio. It's radio for the rest of us.